Most people know that UFOs repeatedly visited Washington, D.C. in the summer of 1952. But few people realize UFOs returned to D.C. 50 years later in the summer of 2002 and were photographed landing on Capitol Hill. Go up to the coasttocoastam.com website and have some fun there. Look at some of the items that our guest Robert Stanley has provided. No one knew how many times UFOs had been sighted in the nation's capital until now. In a moment, Robert Stanley, as we talk about close encounters. Former corporate journalist for Honda Research and Development at Torrance, California, Robert Stanley, currently the editor of Unicus magazine and the author of Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. He has passionately researched UFOs for more than 30 years, and in that time, he has interviewed dozens of eyewitnesses and leading experts. His ongoing investigation of UFOs has been featured on international television and radio and in print. Robert has traveled to over 50 countries in search of answers to ancient mysteries. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Hello, Robert. Welcome to Coast. How are you?
Doing well, George. How are you tonight?
My pleasure. Good. First time guest, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'm honored to be with you and your audience.
Likewise.
Tonight.
Great topic. Robert, first of all, tell me a little bit more about you beyond just the bio that I went through.
Sure. I was born and raised here in Los Angeles and grew up in Malibu. Very fortunate to live out there at Zuma Beach.
And it's gorgeous out there, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, a lot of my peers never really got to travel around as much as I did, so they, you know, it's... You don't really understand what the world is like until you get out and really experience it.
No, that's true.
That's one of the reasons that I'm so passionate about this is because I've had so many bizarre experiences in my life. And, you know, it's kind of hard for me to imagine that all this is happening to me right now. I mean, the catalyst for all this is these photos that we're going to be looking at tonight. It's absolutely bizarre. It's almost like I stuck my finger in a light socket and they can't pull it out.
Well, you know, you have researched what I have always been wondering.
Yes.
Why in the heck nobody has done a thorough job about what very well could be one of the greatest UFO flaps that has ever occurred in this country?
You mean 1952?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of people. Kevin Randall wrote quite a good book about it. But there is what most people don't realize. I didn't have a clue until I really started looking in depth into this. But 1952, they showed up 22 times, not two or three times. They were there 22 times. And
we're not talking about one object.
No, typically not. They usually come in groups. And, you know, the thing is they can range in size from anywhere from the size of a gumball to the size of a city. And it's bizarre to think that these things have been hovering over Washington, D.C. now for, well, what I found is at least 156 years.
Well, back in the 50s, when this occurred in 52, and that would have been Eisenhower, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did we send any planes up in the air? I mean, did we?
Oh, yeah.
What did we do?
Well, they were trying to intercept. The first intercept was 1948, and that didn't go well for the pilot. I mean, he didn't get killed, but later that year, earlier that year, Thomas Mantell actually was killed.
He was killed, yes.
Yeah, yeah, so it does happen. And it was literally like a dogfight. The only thing is that in 1948, the pilot didn't actually shoot at the UFO, but they were charging each other in the sky. It was just and of course, he was outmaneuvered at every point.
Oh, yeah, he could never catch it. Never.
No, and in 1952, when the radars were picking these things up and also looking out the window and seeing them visually, these were obviously not temperature inversion layers like the military offered that it's lame excuse after the fact. But the jets that went up to intercept, the UFOs would disappear, the jets would return to base, then the UFOs would reappear. So they were toying with us, and they were there for hours at a time, George. It's not like they just passed through and that was it.
Robert, it was after World War II. Did we think that these could be Soviet craft somehow?
Sure, they considered it, but the maneuverability, and the fact that they weren't attacking either, that's the part that absolutely befuddles the military, is what do these things want? Why do they keep showing up and toying with us like this?
Just hanging around, right?
Well, as far as we know, they're just – I think they obviously have – I mean, come on.
There's a mission.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, we just aren't privy to what it is.
Well, the mission could also be, here we are, you can't do anything about it.
That's what Commander Dean told me. I mean, according to what he read in the NATO assessment, yeah, that these flybys usually led to landings, and occasionally there was contact of some sort that ensued.
What got you interested in researching UFOs? I mean, it's not something one just wakes up and says, this is what I'm going to do for a living.
That is for sure. when I was just thinking about how I can tell this story briefly, but when I was young, my father had a picture of a UFO in his drawer. It was just a color slide. And I remember looking at that every once in a while and putting it back and thinking, gee, that's really weird. One day I put it inside a do you ever remember the Kodak Viewmaster? It was like a handheld slide projector.
Yes, you push the slide down and squeeze the light
on. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, boy, when I put that thing in there one day and I looked at it, my brain like caught on fire. I was like, wait a second, that is awesome. What is that thing? How could it be? So I started asking my dad questions, and he said, well, the photographer didn't see that at the time, but, you know, it's obviously there. And I said, well, how do you know it's really there? How come somebody didn't fake that? And he says, well, because I actually took it to Life magazine and had it analyzed. And that's when I started really understanding that my dad had an interest in it. But he wasn't really vocal about it. It was just something on the side. And I just give you a reason why. He used to go to Giant Rock Airport with one of his pilot friends. They were both in the Self-Realization Fellowship together, and they knew one of their members had gone out to Giant Rock and was living there with George Van Tassel. So he had some exposure to it even before I was born. And like I said, that picture was in our family. So that was the initial catalyst that made me question, okay, wait a minute, how is it that something could be photographed and yet you can't see it with your eye? How in the world could that happen? And it took me many years before I came up with a satisfactory answer to that.
Two things affected me when I was younger, not about the paranormal world. That started when I was 11 or 12, but a couple of years later on, my mother brought home the book We Are Not Alone by Walter Sullivan, who was the New York Times science writer at the time. And she said, George, read this. Here's something for you. And I just couldn't put it down, Robert.
And what year was that, George?
Oh, that must have been 65, 66, 67, somewhere around there when that book first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then Look Magazine came out with the Barney and Betty Hill, The Interrupted Journey story. Remember that?
I do.
Those two issues, those two episodes in my life hooked me into wanting to research UFOs. I was a kid. I joined NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was located
in D.C.
And, you know, I had my little card, and, I mean, I got the information. I didn't realize at the time, Robert, that there were a lot of heavy hitters in that organization.
Oh, absolutely.
I thought it was like a kids' club for a while, and then I realized, hey, this is serious business.
Well, obviously. I mean, Rear Admiral Hillenkoetter was the first head of the CIA, and he headed up that department there at NICAP. But Major Donald Kehoe wrote quite a bit of stuff for articles and also books, and that's how I really fell deeply into the subject was when I was 13. I was going to junior high, and I walked into the library one day and saw that book, you know, and I read it, and I had to read it twice, and then that was it for me. I couldn't get enough, and I think I must have read every book ever published since that time.
I know Frank Edwards, Ruppolt's books, Hynek's books, everything. I mean, we have followed the same path.
Yeah.
Always, always looking for the possibilities that we've been, visited. There was a case that I just loved. It was in one of Frank Edwards' books. And it had to do with the missionary, and I think they were in New Guinea.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they were waving
at the occupants. I mean, I loved it.
Yeah, I think it was Reverend Gill was his name.
Yeah.
He had some students with him, and they were up on whoever was in the craft was up on an observation deck, and they were, hey, I wanted to ask you, George, have you seen that new movie, Happy Feet?
No, I haven't seen that
one. Okay, I won't spoil it for you, but there is an incredible message in that movie for those of us who know that the extraterrestrials are here and that we need to communicate with them. It's really weird how they slip that in there to a kid's movie, but boy, I couldn't recommend that movie more to people. It's
interesting.
A fantastic piece of work.
Okay, well, you're talking about piece of work. Your work, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill, it's fantastic. And you know, and I've been telling people, this is not a political book here. We're not dealing with those kind of encounters on Capitol Hill. This is a great story.
Well put. put, it's not a red state, blue state kind of thing. But unfortunately, everything that happens in D.C. is political.
Yeah.
And what I found was when I talked to people there off the record, they were telling me, look, you're not going to get anybody to come on the record for your work, because the moment they do that, then they're going to be held accountable. And nobody wants to do that, not an individual, not an agency. They just don't want that albatross around their neck, which I kind of understand. But at the same time, here's my bottom line with this, is that I believe education is the key to our evolution. And as long as this information is being withheld from us, we really can't move on to the next level of our being.
Well, what astounds me about your work, and we'll talk about the 52 case again, because that's, okay, that's a great case, but yeah, your work is really based on the fact that something happened years later.
Well, something profound. And if we didn't have these photographs on film, then we probably, I mean, I would have never done the research. But the fact of the matter is that the person who took those pictures is a former ABC News photographer, engineer. And he worked for them for 18 years. 8 of those years were at the White House. So he wasn't working for ABC News at the time. He had voluntarily retired because his father had was dying from exposure to Agent Orange, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So he took some time off and he was doing freelance work. And three times in 4 months, he accidentally captured pictures of UFOs in prohibited airspace in the middle of D.C., the heart of D.C., where he lives. And it happened on July the 4th when he was working for the city taking pictures of the skyline with the beautiful fireworks. It happened again on July 16th, and it happened again later in November. But in the interim, there was all kinds of weird stuff going on. I mean, 10 days after they landed or filmed landing on the Capitol building, which we've got the pictures up there now, 10 days later, NORAD had to scramble jets to chase the UFOs out of the area.
Now, what was the media doing at the time, primarily radio and print?
You're talking about 2002?
2000, yes.
No, Fox News actually covered the event.
Oh, they did?
They're the only ones. And, you know, here's the thing. There's two independent DVDs that are being in production right now. One of them is by the former ABC News photographer. His name is Mr. Will Allen. And then also Rob Simone was out there recently with a film crew, and he's put together a documentary of the event. They actually found the landing zone for a couple of these objects, and the grass, George, the grass is still burnt to this day. They can't get anything to grow there. It's burned in these spherical...
Oh, that's an incredible story.
Well, here's the other part.
All right,
part.
But they must have shooed this away. I mean,
yeah,
this should be a major story, Robert.
Well, yeah, but at the same, well, how do you break this to the general public? I mean, because look, it's not like they can keep them out. It's, and believe me, they've been trying over the years, and it's not working. And you can't shoot at them. That's not going to work. Although they did.
But is there a need to shoot at them? First of all, I don't think so.
No, that's. That's something that the CIA decided. There was a presidential order in 1950. I think it was 52 when Truman he issued the order to shoot on site, and they quickly rescinded the order. But there's been cases where guys just got an itchy finger and they went for it, and it was not always a good idea for them.
No, not very smart.
No, because they can defend themselves obviously when they need to.
Well, and they do so, based on what we've heard.
Yeah, but most of the time they just evade us because we're not anywhere near. I mean, yeah, I know there rumors are that we've developed some stuff covertly that's based on that, and I'm sure that's true to some degree. But, you know, I mean, what are you going to do? Bring out your covert flying saucer and go into a dogfight over D.C.?
Yeah, so,
that's not going to work either.
So they hold back. Now, were other people... In the 2,000 plus sightings, were other people witnessing this beyond the photographers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's what floored me is when I started to. I mean, I knew going into this, you know, researching this guy's claims that he had the film, but I wanted to get some background. And the more I looked, the more I found, and I was astounded at how many eyewitness accounts that were available. Most of these people have done this anonymously through different websites and publications. But, my God, some of these things, they don't all happen at night either, George. They happen broad daylight. and in front of dozens, if not hundreds, of people. And what are they going to see? But here's the problem, just like the military. What is the average person going to do with that event? Who do they tell, really?
Well, and I've got to say, I mean, this has happened after, right?
Hmm?
After all the tragedies, after the horror that has befallen us.
I mean,
what were we doing? I mean, that now we've got missile launchers all over the place.
Oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, after 9/11, yeah. 2001, yes, they increased security. They increased the prohibited, what's called P-51, is a prohibited airspace, and the center of that starts at the Washington Monument and expands out in a circular area. Then that's surrounded by restricted airspace. So it's by degrees, but you're right. After 2001, things got escalated as far as security, both in the ground and on the ground and in the air. Then in 2003, when we invaded Iraq, they increased the security even greater. And yet, in that period of time, there was over 3,645 what they called incursions. Now, we don't know if those are UFOs, but I kind of don't think they were all Cessnas. You know, it's just and that I found there was a committee, special committee meeting in D.C. that was convened just because they were trying to figure out how to coordinate. I mean, they're putting every agency under the sun on this, and they all coordinate through something called the NRCC, National Capital Regional Control Center. It's bizarre. I mean, how much stuff that I was able to dig up on this in about a year and a half. But
that's the time period you spent writing this book?
Well, yeah, because, okay, here's the thing. Daryl Sims sent me he forwarded me an email from the photographer Will Allen in D.C. with the photos and a brief summary of what happened. And Daryl sent that to me in spring of last year. And I looked at it and I thought, geez, that's amazing. How come I didn't hear about that? If this really happened, I mean, come on. I would imagine somebody would have reported it. But there was a phone number there for the photographer, Mr. Allen. So I figured, hey, I'll call him up. And he answered the phone. We started talking. And I think we've probably had over 1,000 phone conversations since that time, really. I mean, sometimes it's twice a day. I know my wife gets tired of me talking to the guy, but I'm so fascinated by the fact. I mean, here's the weird part. In fact, anybody can read the entire first chapter is all about Mr. Allen and his experiences, which includes the fact that he was abducted as a child when he was in England near Sculthorpe Air Force Base. You see, his father was a high-ranking Air Force officer. And so Mr. Allen was an Air Force brat, and he traveled around the country with, you know, his father, around the world, going to these different Air Force bases, right? So the first time he was abducted by Little Grays was when he was 4 years old. I forget exactly what year it was.
And they kept coming back.
Well, the next time it happened, he was outside Fort Dix in New Jersey. And that place has a huge history. I mean, just like Sculthorpe and Lakenheath? Yeah, I think that's the one. Rendlesham, Lakenheath, Sculthorpe, they're all kind of in that central triangle of. And, you know, most people think that the Rendlesham thing was the height of the activity. It's not. It really was. It started back in the 50s. And they were shooting at them then, too. They were trying to intercept and shoot at them. And, I feel bad for those pilots because, you know, when they came back to base, they had dirty drawers from their experiences.
Oh, and told to not say anything.
Not only just told, they were threatened. You know, most of these guys have been threatened in various ways.
Did you get some people who talked to you off the record or on the record but not to reveal who they were?
Well, yeah. Yes, specifically, Mr. Allen has made, having worked at the White House, he's got quite a few contacts. So his first impression was, after he developed the film, was to take it to the Capitol Police and inform them, hey, something went down here.
And they didn't know? The Capitol Police, they weren't aware of this?
Well, yes and no.
All right, stay with us, Robert. We'll get to that in a moment when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And our guest tonight on Coast to Coast is Robert Stanley. We're talking about his investigative work in his book, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. And again, get up to the coasttocoastam.com website and take a look at some of the pictures that we are and have been and will be talking about. Robert, let's talk about. So Capitol Hill police were told about the UFOs on film, right?
They were shown one particular image that was taken on the Senate side of the Capitol, the 3.5-minute exposure, and that close-up is actually on your website, this green spherical thing with it's like a cloud of energy around
yes.
it. There was four of those things, and they moved across the sky, generating a wormhole. At that time, the photographer was burned by the radiation and emitted. I mean, his fingertips and the top of his head were a little bit scorched by that radiation.
And what was the distance, do you think, between the objects and the photographer?
He measured it out recently in the documentary. They did a bunch of measurements for all the different things, and I don't have the exact. It wasn't that far, though. I mean, the reason that he got burned. I mean, we know for sure UFOs emit radiation. There's a whole section in there thanks to Captain Edward Ruppelt. He made it very clear that back in the 40s they accidentally stumbled on the connection between radiation coming out of UFOs. But and we know for a fact that people and plants and cars and things have been burned by it. But when you generate a wormhole, from what I found in the scientific literature, is that theoretically, if we could do that, when it collapses, there's an exit, like a backwash of energy that spits out of that hole or tube, whatever you want to call it, and that's called Hawking's radiation. Theoretically, of course. And
theoretically.
Obviously,
right.
They did it. Now, what's so weird about that picture is that it's a 3.5-minute exposure. It was taken just with ambient light, and it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and he used a polarized filter over the lens. And what that allowed us to see is the energy spectrum of the craft, especially as they generated the wormhole. It looks like a fractal in the sky. It's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my career, and like I said, I've been at this for quite a while. It took us quite some time to even figure out what we were looking at. But, yes, the Capitol Police were informed a few days after the event. Mr. Allen went there. He spoke with the detective division, and he showed them that image, and they displayed it on a very large screen, and they didn't know what to make out of it.
Were they interested in looking at it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were very interested, and they didn't, like I said, they weren't sure what it was, and they tried to throw out some ideas like fireworks and stuff, and that didn't seem to fit. And Mr. Allen insisted that wasn't the case. And besides, you don't get radiation burns from fireworks.
Yeah, that's right. Plus, though, you know, if it was happening on somebody's watch.
Oh, God, if anybody did anything. The Capitol Police are on duty 24/7, and they do have security cameras working all the time. When they went back to check their security cameras, they found there was these things didn't register on the camera for some reason. Now, part of the reason is that those are older digital cameras, and those things have been upgraded since, I can't say exactly what date, but they're in the process of upgrading that system. And confidentially, what Mr. Allen was told is that that wasn't the first time that they've had close encounters that the Capitol Police definitely know of more events. And in fact, some officers have had to write in their logs the events that transpired on their watch. And it severely disturbed them.
How would you rate Washington, D.C. as a location for UFO sightings compared to other spots on the planet?
Well, that's a good question, George. Part of my research, I came across Larry Hatch is a UFO statistician. And he had put on his website that Washington, D.C. has the highest UFO sightings per square mile of any place on the world, which I thought was a little odd until I contacted him, and he told me how he got the information. That was with only 50-some sightings over a 30-year period. And so, I got up to about 100 sightings in my database, and I thought, gee, that's a lot more than anybody else has ever found. But then I realized, there's probably a lot more that are just obscure, and I kept pushing and pushing until I found 224 eyewitness accounts within a 156-year period. And here's what's strange, and I knew this would happen, is that as soon as the book came out, more people started sending me information. So the account is now 224 and counting. I don't know if I'm going to go into a second edition or if I'm just going to publish updates in the Unicus magazine, but this information definitely needs to come out. In fact, one of your listeners emailed me a photograph that his father took in front of the Capitol building in like 1949 or 1950, And that's on my the front page of my website. And it's just a black and white photo, but there's clearly a couple of UFOs over the dome.
That's exciting.
It's wild stuff.
Now, you have interviewed, or you have a number of eyewitness accounts of D.C. sightings, right, in your book?
Yes, over 200.
All right, let's take a couple of them. Give me some of the juicy ones.
Well, the daytime ones are what I think is probably the most compelling. From most recently, hold on a sec, looking in here.
All right.
There have been accounts here where literally dozens of people were stopped in their car during, like, this one was July 11th. Something about July. I don't know why everything goes crazy in July, but
and the 11th.
But specifically July in D.C. seems to be a very busy time. But there's this woman is a, you know, very credible individual, and she said she was stuck in traffic on Rhode Island Avenue about 11 a.m. on a Saturday morning, bumper-to-bumper traffic, and she saw something in the sky. She said it looked like a star. But then the star started descending, okay? And she said it came down out of the sky. She said it was a very large silver metallic dome circular UFO, hovered for about 10 minutes above the tree, about the size of a football field. It hovered and then sped away silently. She said it was shiny like aluminum foil, but was so shiny it was almost looked like liquid. The treetops were even reflecting in the metal. It hovered very close to me as I drove down Rhode Island Avenue. The traffic was very busy, so I wasn't going anywhere. She said I looked up, and she said she knew other people could see it too because they were looking up at it. And she said it really gave her the creeps. And you know, at one point she started thinking, "Please go away." And immediately after that, the thing began to slowly just, you know, pick up speed and move back up into the sky. But that was 1993. In 1992, this one's really weird, is in the afternoon, so it's still daytime, April 13, 1992, on the mall, dozens of people, right? I mean, that place is always crammed with tourists. And according to this English family that was there on holiday, dozens of people started pointing up at the sky because they were looking at this very large UFO. It was a very large, bright, disc-shaped UFO floating silently at approximately 30,000 feet over the heart of Washington, D.C. Following that huge UFO were 10 smaller UFOs that were shining brightly as they passed over the Washington Monument Complex, directly, which is located directly behind the White House. So those are just in the 90s. I mean, the things that happened, of course, what happened in just this decade are probably the most profound. And, you know, like I was trying to say to you, the timeline is really incredible, that after they landed on the 16th of July, 2002, they showed up 10 days later and were chased out. That's the 26th. They showed up again on the 30th and were chased out again. Then in September of that year, minister and his wife and some friends were visiting D.C. The wife said, "Oh, honey, please pull over. I want to take a picture of the Capitol."
Right.
Right. So when they take the picture, it's 9 o'clock at night. They go back to their hotel room and download the pictures. And lo and behold, there's a UFO over the Capitol Dome. Now, he said it was really interesting. He said, I'm not going to post this on the Internet because I think this might be worth some money. So I've been trying to find his character. I don't know where he is. He's somewhere in Texas.
Nobody's bought his pictures yet. I don't. Well, maybe somebody did.
No, I haven't seen it, but I'm
sure. To keep it quiet.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure at some point it'll surface. But then, in December 16th, 2002, they showed up. The UFO showed up again during the daytime. The military scrambled jets again, and this time somebody on the ground saw it, and who lived in D.C. and she was a former, you know, Air Force brat too. And she was very familiar with aircraft, and she said when she looked up, she saw the aircraft, and then she saw this other thing, and it was hovering very low over the buildings. And she said obviously the jets couldn't catch it; it was too low. And then
they escape? Why don't they just stay there? I mean, they can't be shot down, I don't think. So
well, that's not necessary. Wait a second, hold on, George. They have been shot down, but you're touching on a very, very sensitive subject. In 1952, when the orders were issued, yes, there was a small, I mean a very small, like 2-foot wide disc that was shot at, and a piece of the metal was knocked off of it, which was later analyzed. But I don't think anybody was in that. That was one of those sort of drones that
yeah,
you know,
robotic, a robotic craft.
Yeah, and it's picking up information, and I guess they got a lucky shot or whatever. But my point being is that there have been many larger craft with individuals in it that have been shot at by us. But then there's the other ones, George, that just fall out of the sky, and they've obviously been damaged by something.
Like Roswell.
Yeah, and also Farmington. And there's many cases where you have to wonder, who the heck shot that thing down? It wasn't us, especially back in the 40s and 50s. In fact, this is not going to even sound plausible. The first UFO that was ever shot down that I know of in recorded history was 1917 by Baron von Richthofen, the Bloody Red Baron, in Belgium.
He shot one down?
Yeah, he did. I mean, according to his wingman, that's what happened. Early one morning, they were on patrol over Belgium in their Trifokker aircraft. And those guns were, I mean, those guys didn't mess around. Those were some, they really flying some heavy lead coming out of those things. And when they saw this thing, they immediately assumed it was enemy aircraft, and he was a deadeye, and he just started shooting at the thing, and it fell like a rock out of the sky, and then it crashed into the woods, and according to his wingman, he says that a couple of little bald-headed guys got out and ran off into the forest. Well, at the time, they figured, you know, we had just entered the war,
right,
being the U.S., and they thought, and that was World War One, by the way, folks. These German guys thought that was our stuff
and our guys.
But at the well, how would they know any different? 1917. I mean,
you wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Who heard of UFOs or aliens?
Right.
Come on. But after the fact, this is many years later. He said back in the 50s, it started dawning on him that what the Baron had shot down was clearly not our stuff. You know, it wasn't anything ever built on Earth.
Who confiscated it? The Germans?
Well, he didn't say, because after they shot it down, they just returned to base. I mean, they were ordered not to talk about it. But yeah, I would assume the Germans would have gone after it. And
where'd the little occupants go?
How would I know that? I would have to assume they were picked up
by their own?
Yeah, I would imagine. So yeah, because these things never fly alone.
No, that's true.
You know, they're always.
See, I've always wondered why Roswell occurred the way it reportedly did,
mm-hmm,
and why the extra ships that must have been around didn't pick them up fast.
It's a good question. According to Daryl Sims, and he studied this quite a bit, he said that was a Trojan horse, that they wanted us to acquire that technology and that biological entity.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, it's a lot more complicated than people think. And I heard it, you know, there's a very popular talk show host who will remain nameless that has a conspiracy show once a month. And he was trying to say the other day that the Roswell thing was all bunk and that people really didn't start talking about it until like the 60s. And there's no such thing as aliens. But the truth of the matter is, I found in my book that there was plenty of people back even in the 30s that had close encounters with aliens, not just UFOs, but
right. We just didn't have media,
right,
as widespread as we have today.
Well,
that would have allowed that. I mean, we all know in Roswell, the Air Force themselves released a report that said we have picked up a crashed saucer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they backtracked right away. They changed it. But I mean, I remember seeing Walter holding up a article, mm-hmm, of a newspaper. That says, UFO, what was it, Air Force or UFO is captured.
Well, but, you know, so this is the problem, though, George. What do we do with these things, even if we can catch them? It's not like...
We haul them off to Wright-Patterson or Area 51.
Right, but that's what I said about education. There's a treasure trove of information that's being withheld from the general population, and that's not fair to us.
No, and it always will be, I'm afraid.
Well, that's why I say we go do an end run around these guys, honestly. I think it's about time that people put democracy into action. And if you want to take a minute, we can talk about this event that I'm promoting. I just loosely call it, for now, we're calling it CosmicConcert.com.
Cosmic. Concert?
Yeah, cosmicconcert.com. And what it's going to be is an event where we have...
You're inviting the Star Wars group from the bar, right?
Well, you know how there's benefit concerts and stuff.
Yeah.
But think like American Idol. There's a theme here. I guess we probably should call it Alien Idol. But the idea is we want to get artists and authors to show up at a location and you know, put on a little show to entertain people. But at the same time, you're educating them about the events that have happened and how we really are being visited. And ultimately, the goal is to take a vote electronically from everybody on the planet who wants to participate. And it's a very simple question, George. Should extraterrestrials be allowed to visit or welcome to visit our planet?
Yeah, as long as they don't eat us, like the old Twilight Zone show, to serve man.
Obviously. Obviously not. Nobody would welcome that. I'm just saying, let's just assume that the ones we would welcome are benevolent.
Absolutely.
Okay? So that's the big issue here. We've never put out the welcome mat.
Bring them on.
Well, you can't, and besides, you can't expect the government or the military to do that. It's not the way that the good guys work, as far as I know. They are more democratic, more utopian. So they would, I think, I'm almost positive that they would respond to an event like that. And if we get a simple majority of the vote says, yes, we would welcome you to visit us, I think that's when they will show up overtly. Because obviously they're here covertly. Both good and bad.
So you believe that if there's a massive public appeal for them to just come down, don't worry, show yourself.
Well, I wouldn't say don't worry, because there's obviously going to be opposition to this.
And someone's always going to try to shoot them down.
In fact, there is a friend of my sister, when she was in Colombia, she was abducted, and I don't really like that word, because most of the people that are taken are returned. But there are quite a few, unfortunately.
Yeah, but but are they taken... you know, under their own willpower? Probably not.
No. So, yes, abduction.
So they are abducted.
Yeah, but they are returned. You know, here's why I don't like that term, is because when humans abduct other humans, you usually never come back.
Well, yeah, some people get kidnapped and returned. It's still a kidnapping.
Kidnapped, then. Maybe that's a better word. I don't know, because, like I said, these people are, most of the people we know about are returned intact, more or less. What disturbs me, though, George, is I have found out recently, though, that some people are taken and never returned, and it's not like they're put into vats for food. They're literally taken off this world to colonize other worlds.
See, and that's where David Jacobs comes in. He's a staunch believer in this. He will be a guest, by the way, on Coast to Coast on Friday the 14th.
Oh.
We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Robert Stanley. We're going to go back now to 52 and come forward, and he's got some astounding things to say. Robert, what was happening in the 50s that would necessitate this incredible UFO flap over Washington, D.C.?
That's a good question. It wasn't just D.C. It was everywhere. 1952 and 1957, they were seen worldwide in large numbers. And the reason I believe they were showing up like that is because we were developing the hydrogen bombs. And it's I'm sure they were concerned that we would be killing more and more of our own kind, the real problem is that their technology, when we talk about extraterrestrial, we really should call them extra-dimensional, the ones that can go in these stargate wormholes, whatever you want to call
right.
it. Okay? So when we do the nuclear thing, here's the problem. At the core of a nucleus, of an atom, is a miniature black hole or a singularity. And when we detonate a nuclear bomb, we're literally disturbing other dimensions.
You may be right about that. I've always suspected that one of their concerns is not us blowing us up. It is primarily doing something within the universe that would disrupt them.
Well, yeah, or the other universe. I'm losing my voice.
Oh, I tell you, take a minute. You got some water by you or something?
It's not helping. It'll pass in a second.
All right. Well, hey, look, let me talk to you. Let me ask you a long question while you go over there and put the phone over the bottom of the telephone and clear your throat and get yourself back. Because, see, I have the luxury of I have the luxury of a cough button here, Robert. That means whenever that is going to happen to me, I do this. Watch this.
You're gone. Where'd he go?
Say, try doing a whole interview by yourself, Stanley. And I can do that, and it's great.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm feeling a little better now.
So anyways, we have this flap. You see it's worldwide,
yep.
and you think it's because we're dabbling in the atomic world.
Well, we clearly were and still are, but at that time, think about it, we were detonating them even in the upper atmosphere.
Yeah, we were going crazy, and the race was on to do more and more.
Right, right. And I get the feeling that's the work of the dark forces. Not just bad humans. I think that's the bad ETs that are influencing us at that point. They were really pushing us to do nefarious deeds for them.
What do you mean, the bad ETs?
Well, so there are clearly, you know, the best. I'm going to have to do this again. Hold on.
All right. No problem. No problem. I'll just do the show by myself, Robert. I don't care.
The best analogy. I have no control over that. The best analogy is Star Wars. You've got good guys,
yes.
And then you've got the Empire. And I guess we'd have to, in this reality, we'll have to call them the Federation versus the Empire. The Empire or imperialists are, they build empires. I mean, that's what they do. And it appears very manipulative and controlling, and it is, but that's what they do. I mean, so abducting people, putting them on other worlds, establishing colonies that are not democratic or utopian, that's just how they operate. And they are at odds with the Federation of Free Worlds, as far as I know. And so, like I said, that's where we get a lot of these crashed UFOs, and I believe the bad guys are really the ones behind the abductions and
the crashes?
Okay, abductions, like I said, we know about abductions because some of these people are returned. What we don't know, unfortunately, is about the people that never come back.
That are not returned. That's a big planet, and a lot of people disappear.
Well, and I think that's how we got here. As in fact, I know this is going to really upset some people, but I think this planet is part of the Empire, and the good guys are trying to liberate us, and we don't even know it. And that's one of the reasons that the military and the government, I mean, that's one of the whoever's really running the show behind the scenes, the shadow government, that's why they don't want us to interface with the good guys.
See, I think this hybrid program that mm-hmm. we talk about mm-hmm. is based on them trying to genetically take out of us mm-hmm. this warmongering ability of human beings, this ability to want to kill,
right.
this ability to want to hate. I think they're trying to breed that out of us.
Well, maybe the good guys are, but that's just to counterbalance what the bad guys have done. They've actually made us into warriors.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know.
Okay. I agree.
So it's a push and pull thing. It's like, and we're caught in the middle of it. And that's why I say, as long as we're in denial, obviously it's not a healthy state of mind for an individual, let alone collectively a species.
Well, I tell you what, when we open up phone lines later, we're going to get more than just questions about what's going on over Washington D.C. because you've opened up an interesting new can of worms here.
Well, but see, it's all connected, you know. And here's the in the assessment that came out in 1963 or so, that the one that Commander Dean saw at NATO, they said at that point they already knew there was at least four races visiting the planet frequently. One of them was reptilian. There was the tall gray, and then there was the little biological.
And the Nordics.
And then there's the Nordics.
Right.
And those guys really were the ones that bothered our military the most because obviously they can infiltrate. Now, I happen to be friends with one of those beings who's here covertly, and he was brought here as an infant, and there's a whole chapter in this in a book. I know it sounds utterly fantastic, and I don't blame people for being skeptical, but I'm relating this as honestly as I can. There are human ETs living here among us in our own society. But it goes further than that.
What do you mean by human ETs? What's that definition?
Yeah, well, they are totally human because we are related to them, and they are here. And the reason they're here covertly is they're trying to help counteract some of the negative things that the bad guys have been doing to us.
So these are the good guys.
Yes. That's what I was saying. This planet, as far as I can tell, is under the control of the Empire, the bad guys. And I mean, I just think there's no other way to say it. Good guy, bad guy. It's just,
I understand.
You know, so the bottom line is that they are here, and that there's also quite a few different ETs that are coming and going because they have bases here. Obviously, they're under the water and they're under the ground,
or in mountainsides, or
right,
something like
right,
that.
Right.
Okay.
Right. In fact, my wife had an encounter like that in Peru. She actually got to go inside one of their bases there, and the people were totally human.
Wait a minute now, Robert.
Yeah.
Tell me this one.
Okay.
What's your wife's name?
My wife's name is Irene.
Irene, all right. Tell me all about this.
Well, she's the publisher of Unicus Magazine, and that's how we met. She went to Peru. She had a close encounter, I mean face-to-face encounter, where they took her inside the...
How did this happen? Did she go to Peru based on the fact that this was going to happen?
Yeah. She had read some of Shirley MacLaine's material, and she was very interested in this and ultimately was influenced to... She felt if she went there, she was going to have an encounter. And that's
all right. So she went there under the auspices of an encounter was going to occur.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, she actually went with a tour group that they claimed they would, you're going to see a UFO if you come with us kind of thing. And a lot of people do, because there's obviously active bases there in the mountains and under the water.
That's an interesting way to sell a travelogue.
Oh, I know.
See a UFO and take a little trip.
Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing. When they were it happened on the last night of a 2.5-week journey, and they were up in the mountains there at Lake Titicaca, and it was at nighttime, and my wife had this premonition that something was going to happen at 9 o'clock. To be prepared. They were sort of mentally sending messages, because apparently they're very good at this telepathy thing. And so she and her roommate opened the windows at 9 o'clock, and sure enough, suddenly there was a light show that started happening over the lake. And what started off as one or two UFOs, so they would pulse, and then they would merge, and then they would separate, and then somehow they had multiplied. It was probably they were creating a stargate. That's looking backwards on it. I think that's what they were doing, because this went on for about an hour. And then she said to her roommate, "Hey, let's try and invite one to come over here." So they did. They started, mentally trying to project, "Hey, why don't you come and visit us?" Well, one of the UFO breaks away and starts gradually coming across the lake towards their hotel room, and they freaked out. They almost had. She said she almost had a heart attack. She was so scared that this thing was literally coming at them. So. And at that moment, when they started panicking, it stopped and backed away. So then they were disappointed, like, oh,
darn,
we just blew it. It was responding, and now we're...
Well, it picked up on them.
Yes.
Yeah.
They read our brainwaves, absolutely. They know everything we're thinking and feeling, whether we like it or not. That's just the way it is. We're totally transparent to them. So at some point, though... Watching the activity, my wife got tired. She laid down. Next thing she knew, this spherical thing had come in the room. Somehow it went right through the window, came in there, and took her out through the window, across the lake, into the mountain where there was this city. And she said everything was lit up, and there was where it took her was like to a landing area, like almost like a field, open tarmac. And that there was UFOs parked there, and that she was guided. Somehow she knew where to go. She went into one of these buildings. She said it just looked like an ordinary bar,
Sure. Basically.
And there was a guy standing behind the bar, a man.
A bartender?
Well, I guess so.
An alien bartender.
No, but it's really funny, George, because the way she described it was so compelling when he turned around, she said he looked at her in a way that nobody has ever done before. And she said... She knew at that moment that he knew everything about her from the moment she was born to the very moment she was standing in front of him. Everything was totally, totally transparent. And she said her heart was burning like a tingling sensation. And she said she was embarrassed and overwhelmed all at the same time. She had to, like, look away because it was just too much. But he started to talk to her and explain, some things, very esoteric things. And after that exchange, he took her outside, and she saw where people were working in gardens, growing food. And the next thing she knew, she was waking up. Somehow they put her back, and she just couldn't remember that part.
Did she think this was a dream, Robert?
Well, partially, yeah, except other people had the same damn dream. How can that be? I mean, I interviewed some of those people. One of them had worked for TRW. It's like, he wasn't part of that group. He was with a different group. He just happened to be down there. But I did meet him later. And anyway, after that experience, my wife came back and started the magazine. And then that's how we met. She was at a UFO conference, and she got up there and started talking about it. And I just fell in love with her, and the rest is history. We've been together ever since.
Or did you fall in love with the UFO story, knowing you were going to write a book?
Well, actually, you know what? My next two books are novels based on my experiences growing up, meeting her, and then the second novel is how, you know, all about backstory on her and how she meets me, and we do this magazine. And in fact, you and I are living the end of the second novel right now. It's bizarre, but...
Well, really?
Yes. Yeah. That novel is called 333. And the first one's called Mystic Malibu. The second one's called 333. And
I like that name.
Well, it's something she was. It's a code. It's a code. It's something about this interdimensionality, and it's an energy signature that she was shown by this being inside the mountain. That was her energy frequency. It's bizarre, but anyway, I'm sorry to get off on that.
Well, no, that's okay. It was an interesting story. So, I mean, because, you know, that's a part of the perspective of all of this. So, well, and again, though, we're back in 52.
Yeah.
This massive atomic series of explosions and testing going on by the Soviets and us.
Yeah, huge explosions.
And these objects are showing up like huge numbers, right?
And not just showing up. They were trying to intervene. And that's the thing. At that point, that's when the CIA convened the Robertson panel about 1957, and they said, well, what are we going to do about this? And they came to the conclusion that they were treating everybody equally. It wasn't like they were singling us out. You know, it was, they were treating the Russians the same as us. And essentially, they were trying to throw up a roadblock to our progress on the nuclear development. And, of course, we didn't listen, and they had to do some pretty extreme measures to get our attention. Like,
and so the one of those, of course, over Washington, D.C.
That would be correct, and it really scared the military. But here's the thing, according to Ruppelt...
But we didn't stop either.
No, of course not. Well, it's not just we. There's these little groups, these very powerful elite groups that are pulling the strings. It's not like collectively we go, everybody wakes up in the morning and go, yeah, I need another nuclear bomb. No, it's these special groups that have an agenda to serve. And see, this is where it goes back to, again, if the bad guys are here and the good guys are here, they're both influencing us. So our leaders, who are they being influenced by? Clearly, if you look at judge them by their actions, most of the time they must be influenced by, I'm not saying like we're all robots, you know, or puppets. It's just that these guys mentally are very good at influencing people, whether we realize it or not. They have that ability, and we're sort of...
Well, we're at their beck and call, aren't we?
The bad guys, yes, because, okay, look, when Daryl, when he had his abduction in 1952, his first one, he's 4 years old or 5 years old, they paralyzed him, and then the ET tried to use hypnosis on Daryl to make Daryl perceive the extraterrestrial as though it were a circus clown. Now, that's hypnosis. That's mind power. It's like, you know, and so some people talk about these things morphing into, be shapeshifters. I don't think they're physically changing their shape. They're mentally projecting something to our mind, like hypnosis, that so we perceive them differently, but they haven't changed a bit. You know, it's just our perception. That's how powerful their minds are.
So the flap ends when?
It hasn't. That's the funny part. You know, you think it ended in 52 or 57 and there was nothing in between. My God, when I sat down and actually put this thing together, chronology of things from 1850 to 2006, we've got multiple sightings throughout the 60s. I mean, really a lot in the 60s here. For some reason, it drops off. There's very few in the 70s. There's very few in the 80s. And then it picks up again dramatically in the 90s. And, of course, this decade, it's gone nuts.
But you would think in this era now of video everywhere, cell phone cameras, we'd get more and more pictures. Now, you've given us some great ones.
Do you want to look at some of those?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go start with your website.
Hey, everyone, go to the coasttocoastam.com website, and you will find right under Robert's name a series of photographs.
Yeah, this first one is the most dramatic, and that's the first one I laid eyes on, which this is the catalyst for me writing, doing a year and a half of research and writing the book. It's clearly there's one over the dome, but what you have to draw your attention to is the one that's landed on the Capitol building next to the dome. That thing, and then you look below it, these two images side, or a, you know, one on top of the other.
And again, paint a picture for those people who don't have computers.
Oh, I'm sorry. What we're looking at here are two images that were taken moments apart, and you can literally see that the object that was landed on the Capitol building's roof has now taken back to the air and is in flight. It's in motion. So it's pretty obvious what they're doing there. I think the military calls this an away mission. And like the one above the dome is actually keeping watch for the one that's landed there just in case something really goes wrong.
Some of them look like orbs, don't they?
Well, absolutely, they are. But these are huge. I mean, relatively speaking, the orbs that most people have photographed are tiny.
Now, do you think these would have been seen by the naked eye, people who are out there, those kinds of eyewitnesses?
Clearly they were. But like I said, the photographer was there doing a commercial photo shoot for a local recording artist, and they were actually filming an album cover. But the subject definitely saw it. You can see it in his face. He's scared. There's something weird. He knows there's something weird going on. He doesn't know what it is. And his manager clearly saw something, and, of course, the photographer did too. But remember, these guys are all focused on doing something. I mean, there's a lot of money being exchanged for this photo shoot, and they're trying to get it done and get out of there. And so that they didn't really know what the heck was going on at the time. But obviously there was something. Now, if you go below that picture of the dome, this other thing that looks like a sort of a snowflake pattern or a fractal, that's a close-up of the Stargate.
Yeah, okay.
And it's bizarre to look at it and realize that they were able to generate that. Just their whatever mode of power they're using is incredibly powerful because it takes, I mean, according to all the scientific literature, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to warp space like that.
All right, when we come back, we'll look at photo 4 and then the rest of them on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you, give you an opportunity to talk with Robert Stanley about the cases that we're talking about here in Washington, D.C., and we still have got lots to talk with him about. But back to the coasttocoastam.com website, the pictures he has supplied us. Robert, let's pick up picture number 4, which is called the energy signature left in the sky as 4 UFOs generate a Stargate. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to tell you, I'm checking my email, and your listeners are really excited about this idea of cosmic concert. I didn't know I was going to get such a huge response.
Oh, yeah, they love this.
Well, maybe we need to do, you guys should, we should work out a simulcast for the event with you. Really be exciting, because I, you know, what we want to do is a webcast as well as the audio. We want people to be able to download it on their computers and watch it anywhere on the planet. Okay, the energy signature is one of the most bizarre UFO photos I've ever seen.
It actually looks like a huge UFO that might have left an imprint somewhere.
Well, the 4 of them traveled together. As we move down, you'll actually see the group of 4 as they moved across the sky. But what we're looking at here is a filtered version where we reduced out the color and boosted the contrast and the brightness in a way that you can actually see the energy signature that they generated this warp in space and left our dimension. And it's just it's the weirdest picture I think I've ever seen. And I know back in the 50s the military was trying to get this kind of information photographically and they were unable to do it. But I'm pretty sure they figured out better ways now over since the 50s how to do it. But here's something I got to tell you and your audience. These pictures that we're looking at are only available because Will Allen's father passed away. Now, let me explain.
Yes.
Well, here's the thing. Because he was an Air Force officer, he obviously knew about this. And when as he was ill and dying, one day Will said to his dad, you know, I took these pictures, Dad, I got to show you this. And his dad got really angry, and he says, don't ever show those to anyone, ever. Now, if he had lived beyond November 2002, Will told me that he would have, you know, followed his father's wishes and not shown those pictures,
mm-hmm.
You see? So in a way, the military would have prevented us once again, even from seeing these particular shots. And, in fact, in 1952, I kept finding reference to hundreds of people on the street that actually saw this and that there was dozens of people taking pictures and movies. And I kept thinking, where are they? Now, when I interviewed Colonel Wendell Stevens, he said, when I asked him about if he knew what happened to him, he said, oh, yeah, they were all confiscated by the Army. And that only one of those pictures ultimately accidentally
got out. Huh?
Yep, it leaked out. it got leaked out. And somewhere, those movies and photos are still being held as classified. But here's the weird twist, and you'll see this later in this page. Walt Disney Studios actually has some of that movie footage. And I've been trying to get their legal department to give us access to it. I got the name of the person. I've talked to the guy, the archivist at the library. I know they've got the footage that they aired on television, one of their documentaries in 1995. But they're dragging their feet. They really don't want to give it up. They don't want to let us have a copy to air. So It's a weird – I mean, this situation is bizarre. But the pictures we're looking at here are all on the CD, the free CD that comes with my book, which, by the way, if you want the book, it's only available at my website, Unicus Magazine.
It's not on Amazon or anything
no,
like that?
No, I just don't feel like giving up control at this point. I don't really – there's a reason I don't trust anybody right now, and we'll get to that in a minute.
All right. With this subject matter.
With this particular subject matter, I don't think it's wise for me.
All right.
So anyway, number five is a close-up, extreme close-up of one of the – UFOs that generated one of the four UFOs.
Looks like a blob of plasma.
Well, yeah, again, because the film was heavily saturated with light. I mean, the shutter was open for 3.5 minutes, so all this light kept flooding into it. So you can literally see what this is called field propulsion. And that is a plasma, you're right. It's being generated by the onboard propulsion system, and it you can see how it's in layers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the echo effect. David Adair is a friend of mine. He's featured in a chapter. By the way, I talked to him today. He said to say hi to you.
Great. Yeah, he's a good guest.
But he was telling me how if we ever wanted to warp space, we would need to make this echo effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a laser beam kind of bounces back and forth until it gets strong enough. Well, the same thing's true for what these UFOs were doing, warping space. Let's jump down to the next one, number six. This is an extreme close-up of the object landed on the Capitol building.
Okay, and remember now, some people don't have computers, so paint us pictures.
It's a sphere that's about the size of a large SUV, but it's a sphere, and it is definitely landed. And it's blue-ish, but you can see that there's a multitude of colors there. And again, the reason this is happening is because it's the it's called ionization. And when the energy is released by the UFO's engines, it creates an ionization of the air around it. That's what the plasma is. It's the air is literally excited, like electricity would do, or lightning, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Below that, image number seven. Now, this is really important. This is where we get – this is what the original image looks like when you don't filter out the colors and everything, you know, play with the
colors. It still looks pretty neat.
Well, here's what's happening. They're moving into the Stargate at an extreme rate of speed.
Is every dot a UFO?
Yes.
Okay.
And the four of them are moving together, and it's not like they just when you think about it, what they did was they streaked across the sky, but they're pulsing. They're pulsing
in each pulse, that's the four of them. We're not looking at 12.
No.
Okay.
No, that's what I couldn't understand either at first. But you can see, you know,
Or what if that's just one big object and there's four lights under it?
No, that's not how it works, right, George, because you can see like a Doppler effect. You know how sound diminishes as it moves further away?
Yeah.
So you get the same effect here with these objects as they move further away from the camera. They get smaller, but they don't really change their shape or their configuration.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yes.
That's how we figured it out. Plus, we also did some other analysis that you'll see in the DVD someday. But these things are absolutely bizarre. What I've come to learn, and believe me, I spent a lot of years researching the technology behind it, because actually when I worked at Honda, that was one of the things I was researching. I got to read up on all the books about John Searle, Professor Searle, and also Schauberger. And, I mean, huge manuals. I got to study all that stuff.
All right, let's move to number eight.
Okay. That's 1942 over the Pentagon. Now, on the left-hand side, that's a close-up of the UFO that's on the right-hand side. Yeah, most of these things are, I mean, like I said, almost all the pictures I've seen were caught accidentally, because when you go down below that to number nine, this woman was just posing for the photographer, Mr. Allen, on a street corner in D.C., and suddenly this thing showed up, this little sphere about the size of a gumball.
I don't think that's a full moon back there or something?
No, sir, it's not. It's absolutely over her head. In fact, when you close up on it, you can actually see it's reflecting the color of her hair. and the polished surface of the object.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just beyond belief. But that's what happened. Image number 10, that is, now here we are. We're looking at a still image from the Disney television documentary. Mm-hmm. That's from the movie, one of the confiscated classified movies.
This is great video films.
Well, have you seen that one?
I have seen the picture that's your last one. That picture I've seen somewhere.
Oh well, it's been on websites, but what I want to see, George, is the actual movie. Okay, because we're just looking at one still. The description from the people who posted this image, they said that the UFOs are dancing around the Capitol Dome at night.
Well, it looks like they are.
I would like to see them do the dance, though.
Yeah, you would.
You know, because I'm sure it would be interesting, and I know that's why they confiscated the movie footage, because it's obviously not Venus or any of that other stuff that they said about temperature inversion.
Let's jump to 12. Okay, picture 12.
Well, hang on a second. Number 11 is important because that was the night that they landed. This is actually part of the – see, he was using a semi-wide-angle shot there. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that went down. In fact, when you look at the cover of the book, what that is a composite of three different shots. I cut the UFOs that he captured on film, and I pasted them on a stock footage to give you an overview, like a summary of all the stuff that was photographed within about a 20-minute period that morning.
Okay.
All right. But there is a disc-shaped UFO hovering over the reflecting pool. It's the disc-shaped object on the left-hand side, not the other thing that's a street light.
Okay.
Okay, there's a difference there. Now, this is the only photo. Number 12 is the only one that was accidentally released. And like I said, Colonel Stevens actually gave me this.
And it's great stuff.
Well, they claim that those are – now, this is nuts. The skeptics say that these are actually lens flares coming off of the lights of the building of the Capitol. And it's obviously not that. I mean, it's not even close to that because they're behind the dome. You see?
Well, the documentary that Disney has, all right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The movie that this is a still photo from the movie shot in July of 1952, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Is that the same as the picture we're looking at now?
No. This is a still photo, George, that was taken by a news photographer. He went to the office, and one of the other news guys said, hey, that's pretty cool. And so he said, well, if you want, I'll make you a copy. Well, this is before the military had gone around confiscating.
Is that guy still alive? I mean, 54 years later.
I highly doubt it, but I wouldn't know who that person is, because he then gave that copy to his friend, August Roberts.
Well, let me ask our public here, our audience, because maybe they may know. If anybody knows who this photographer was, who took this picture in July of 52 that we're looking at on the coasttocoastam.com website, get a hold of us.
That would be good.
Especially, let us know if he's still alive or dead. I mean, I'd love to find this guy if he's still around.
Yeah. Could you possibly go to unicusmagazine.com, the front page?
Yeah, I can do anything.
Okay. Well,
I'm Merlin here.
The technology, it is miraculous. If you scroll down on my front page there, you'll see that photo that was submitted by one of your listeners to me today. And it's black and white. It's very old. But if you look closely up in the sky above the dome, you're going to see something. That is not a chemical acid splash on the film. It's more of the same stuff.
And yeah.
That's somewhere between 1949 and 1950.
Okay.
Okay. Now let's go in there and look at the free images for a minute, because there's something else you guys got to see here.
Into the what? Free images.
Free images,
okay.
Yeah. Right, after
in.
You enter my website, go to the free
I'm
images.
There. Okay.
Now look at this. This was taken by Fox News Channel 5 in D.C. They were reporting the Senate is now back in session. That was September 4th. It was Labor Day.
Just this September. Yeah.
It was very recent, yes. And oddly enough, when they went to the B-roll, you know, because whenever they're doing political stories, they always got the Capitol Dome in the background.
Yeah.
When they went to the B-roll of a live camera feed, lo and behold, there's this saucer over the Senate side of the Capitol. And if you look at the dome, it's actually glowing green. Well, that would have to be radiation. And, in fact, the picture just underneath it, that's a close-up enhanced. It's only enhanced by sharpness. And you can literally see the saucer shape of this thing.
Well, there's something up there.
Yeah, well, it's not an aircraft. And listen, that is prohibited airspace right there, folks. You can't just fly through there whenever you feel like it. If you do, you're going to get a military escort, and you're probably going to pay a huge fine, and they're not going to treat you very well. The picture below that was taken by is during the afternoon in early 2000. It was posted on the internet in early 2006. The individual that took it was an eighth grade student on a field trip, and he accidentally captured what looks to me like UFOs, because you can see some of these things are in motion clearly. And they're not moving slowly either.
What's this black helicopter doing over your house?
Thank you. That happened in July 6th of last year, right after I published my first article in Nexus magazine about this story. And I knew something was going to come down, because when I spoke to the Capitol Police, I was trying to verify some stuff through their public relations officer. First thing he does is grill me. What's your name? Where do you live? Who do you work for? Where are you going to publish this article? When is it going to be published? You know, I mean, and what I found out later is these guys report up to a three-letter agency. I guess we'll just say it, NSA.
Well, he'd be in a mess if he didn't ask you those questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's his job, but I'm saying that he passed that information on to his superiors, who then passed it on to their superiors, which, from what I've been told through back channels, is the NSA. They're in charge.
So what were they trying to do, harass you?
It didn't work. I was just sitting here writing the book, and suddenly my whole house starts shaking because this helicopter was literally right over my house. Now, the picture you're looking at is after the fact. They left the area, and then they came back, and that's when I had time to go run into the house and get the camera. But when they first showed up, I walked out of my door, and the thing was literally right there. I could have hit it with a rock. It freaked me out, yeah, but at the same time, I'm like, well, Jesus, what do they want? And they were orbiting my house, and then they, after a few minutes, they went out to the east, and they came back, and they literally went right down my street, like right above the treetops, like they were cruising my street, just like, I don't know, showing off, like flexing their muscle.
Telling the neighbors who their neighbor is.
Well, and the funny thing was, the neighbors weren't home. My family wasn't home, thank God. I think it would have really scared them. And so then they went down the street one way towards the beach. Then they turned around, and they came back. That's when I ran in the house. I figured, well, okay, here's my chance. I'll grab a picture. Nobody's going to believe this. So and this isn't even the close-up picture, but you can see there's no – well, this is not a very close-up, but I guarantee you in the close-up that comes in with the CD of the book, there's no markings on it that you can see with your naked eye. But my brother-in-law's a retired Army officer, and he told me, yeah, those things do have markings, but they got to be landed, and you got to go up to them real close, and it's very dark, you know. But it's like everything military. It's all marked, but, you know.
Whatever. Have you ever had a Men in Black knock on the door?
No, and I'm hoping that never happens. I could do without that. Thank you.
Now, what's this strange photo now?
Accidentally taken on the Mall in the Ellipse, which is right between the Washington Monument and the White House, is the Ellipse. And the Ellipse is famous for anybody who knows anything about UFOs, because that's where Day the Earth stood still, where Klaatu landed his UFO, right?
Yep.
And him and Gort got out, and the rest is history. But anyway, this lady was taking a picture of the menorah that was lit, and she's a photojournalist. I forget her name now. I'm sorry. But she was taking pictures of the menorah, and she said when she got home, she noticed that three of the pictures show these two blue things. She called them angels.
Well, they're weird. You know what? Jose Escamilla, he's the expert on rods.
I know Jose, yes.
This looks like they could be rods.
Well, whatever they are, they're in motion. She said they are ascending. These three things. So if they're lens flares, how come they are moving in each of the three? Unfortunately, she's not responding to my emails, but I would like to see the rest of the pictures so that we could actually see the motion.
Yeah. And you see either a propeller around the top or some kind of field.
It's an energy field. Again, all these things use field propulsion. In fact, this is kind of important to realize. We're experiencing field propulsion right now. The planet actually has its own field propulsion. And as a result, we are moving at thousands of miles an hour, yet we don't feel it. And this is the key thing why the UFOs, when they're even with occupants inside, why they can perform these incredible maneuvers and not crush the people inside, is because of field propulsion. It negates all that. In other words, the propulsion is equally applied to everything and at the same time. It's not like a rocket engine pushing you at one point. You know, it's the entire craft is moving as one. So that's really important to realize, that at some point, these rockets and stuff, I mean, I'm glad they want to go back to the moon and stuff, but please don't do it with rockets. You're going to kill somebody, and it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. No point in doing that. There's clearly better ways to do it.
Bring out the new propulsion.
Well, they've got it covert.
I know that. Yeah. I believe that.
I know.
Yeah, we're going to take phone calls when we come back, Robert. You ready for all kinds of questions?
Oh, boy. Yeah, I can. I thrive on that.
Okay. We'll do that when you come back. And again, people can email you through your website, right?
Correct.
Okay. We'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Robert Stanley. Questions about UFOs over Washington, D.C., or general UFOs, because he's pretty knowledgeable about this. We'll be back in a moment. Hey, Robert, tell us a little bit more about this alien human friend.
He's asked me not to reveal his name.
All right.
But I'll tell you, it's really amazing in the book, which, by the way, like I said, if your listeners want to get a copy, they'd have to go to unicusmagazine.com. It's spelled unicusmagazine.com. And please allow at least 2 to 3 weeks for shipping, because the holidays is just nuts right now.
Oh, absolutely.
But I met my friend J.W., the initials we created.
As long as you don't say J.C., that's okay.
Well, funny you should mention that, because he does have some of the same qualities. He knows how to he's very skilled at healing people in ways that the medical community can't.
No, I'm not talking about that J.C., but that's okay.
Oh, okay.
It's an inside joke.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were saying to Christ.
Very inside.
Okay. Anyway, I met him down the street from where you are located at NBC Studios one day. My wife and I were doing a show called The Other Side, and we met JW down there, and they introduced him as an ET, and I'm like, oh, come on. You
yeah,
know,
right.
He just looked like, I mean, he's very tall and blonde hair, blue eyes, like a Nordic should look, but I'm like, come on, I've never heard of such a thing. But anyway, after the show, I talked to him a little bit, and I got his phone number, and we became friends. And he not only does he firmly believe it, he's told me some things that I actually found was verifiable through people like Colonel Corso.
I mean, does he think he's a hybrid?
No, George, he was brought here as an infant. I highly suggest, I know Tom's got a copy of the book. I suggest you read the chapter called Earthbound Extraterrestrial, because that's JW for you. And he talks in great detail about why the Greys are here, what they're up to, and how Star Wars was actually put up to keep out the good guys from coming in uninvited. It's just a mind blower.
Does he know where he came from?
Tau Ceti.
Where is that?
I don't know. I'm not an astronomer, but it's not that far away. Apparently for them, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Earth. And we're on a travel path anyways between these – I mean, there's trade routes, I should say, between these various galactic centers. The worlds, I should say, are united either as part of the Empire or part of the Free Federation, the Federation of Free Worlds, I should say. And like I said, these guys are at odds with each other. Of course, I think of it this way. There's like a third of them are bad, a third of them are good, and then there's a third in the middle that are just free agents. They could go either way, or they could just care less. And that's just the way I break it down. I know I'm probably oversimplifying things.
How did he ever realize that he was an alien?
Okay, that's a good question, and it's all in Chapter 9, I think, Earthbound Extraterrestrials. He was contacted as a... When he was a teenager, the ET started showing up, and when he was living in Kentucky, and these were humans now, of course, but they landed their craft, and they talked to him, and they said, at some point, they told him, you know, you're welcome to come with us, and he said, because things weren't going that well for him at that point, and he said, but I'm worried about my mom, and they said, well, I'm sorry to tell you this, but that's really not your mother, and he said, what do you mean, and they said, you were brought here as an infant. And adopted by this, and apparently his father was not only a military officer, but he was a high level Mason. And boy, the end of that chapter is a mind blower. When at some point when I started telling JW about I actually found some information that's quite startling. I think I'm convinced that the Masons are having a covert relationship with various ETs.
Oh, you're opening up another can.
Sorry. Sorry. Are you a member?
No.
Oh. Well, I know Art is. I just thought I'd ask. But a lot of people are.
Art isn't. I don't think Art is he?
Yeah, he is.
How do you know that?
Well, I thought he said he was a Mason.
I don't think he did.
Okay. Well, maybe I'm wrong.
By the way, Richard C. Hoagland says Tau Ceti is 10.6 light years away.
And is that a problem if you can move hyperdimensionally, Richard?
You know Richard, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
All right. You ready for some calls?
Yes. Absolutely.
They are lining up here, Robert, for you, and the time is short. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
It's an excellent show and excellent work, what you are doing. And I'm a long-time listener. I have a two questions.
Sure.
One question is that why Army and other agencies are holding back that information from public? I would like to ask Robert.
All right, let him answer that one first. Go ahead, Robert.
Not being in the military, I'm just repeating what I was told by retired military officers, that there's a shadow government that actually runs things, and they are. It's not that they're scared of putting the information out. They just know that once they do this, it's going to change everything, and they could lose their positions of power and authority over us. It's really not any more complicated than that.
Are they that shadow government is a part of? An army and other big agency is a part of that shadow government. You are saying?
No, sir. It's what I just mentioned to you about the Masons. They're aligned with a bunch of other groups. Secret societies are very much allied with one another, as far as I can tell, around the world. And you got to think, just like one group, like the Masons, they have millions of members all over the planet. And these guys are not just like dishwashers. They're in positions of government and military and judges and stuff like that. So they're obviously in a position to influence events.
I see.
Good. Okay.
My other question is that when we talk about the alien or extraterrestrial, what is the similarity between ghosts in a Bible or when we are talking about the haunted houses and we hear a lot of, communication with the ghost? People are going over there and they hear different voices. Sometimes they hear different knocks and other stuff. A friend of mine actually called me a few days ago that they have more than one time happened over there in their house that somebody knocked their door, and when they got out to see that who is knocking the door, there was nobody there. What do you think about the ghost and the alien? They are the same, or are they the separate entity?
You've raised a very excellent point, sir. What I was told by JW is that we all come from that other dimension when we're born, and we all go back to that other dimension, let's call it the source, when we die. What these extra-dimensional beings have learned to do is to move back and forth between the source and our known universe while they're still alive. And so they can appear to do things that we couldn't quite understand. They might appear as ghostly or shadow-like at times, but that's only because they're not quite here. They're coming from another dimension. That's not the best term, but I'm just going to call it another dimension. So they're extra-dimensional travelers, yeah. But then again, so are we all. And in fact, it's what I was saying before. We are all originated from extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional beings.
All right. First time caller line. You're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. This is Shauna from Washington.
State of or D.C.?
The state of.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. I'm just outside of Wenatchee. I just called to tell you a story about when I was, I think I was about 10, actually. I told the screener 12. One night, my brother started hollering, crying, and screaming that he was scared somebody was looking in his window. Well, the odd thing was the rest of my family and I were all standing in a circle in the living room, and we woke up standing in the circle.
Wow.
Now, for some reason, we didn't think it was odd.
Mm-hmm.
But we went back to the bedroom, to see what was going on with my brother, who was about a year and a half older than me. And he said that there was a man with a derby hat smoking a cigar looking through his window.
Wow.
Well, our windows were about 7 foot from the ground. Mm-hmm. And I got on my dad's shoulders, and we went outside, and I tried to see through my brother's window, and it was just almost impossible. And it wasn't until years later that I brought this back up to different members of my family, and they remembered it, but never really thought it was odd that we were all standing, sleeping. And I don't know if that could be contributed to UFOs or what. And I just was curious as your take on that.
Well, it's very interesting, Shauna, but I'll have to, refer back to something that I do know, which happened to a friend of my sister in Colombia when she was abducted. She was taken on board, and one of the beings there who was human, who was a very short-statured man with blue skin, she said to him, why don't you guys just land and get out and show yourself? And he said, because somebody would probably shoot us. And she said, well, you know, and they taught her quite a bit. They were actually very nice to her. But one of the things they told her is, you're not going to remember this when you go home. It's going to seem like a normal event to you. So this is going to be exactly like it's just like you put on your shoes every morning. It's going to be that mundane. When you wake up tomorrow, you're not going to really remember this as anything special. It took about 7 years for it. One night she woke up in a cold sweat, remembering everything. For some reason, it just came flashing back into her mind, everything that happened to her.
Interesting. My brother had nosebleeds all of his life, too.
Well,
and I didn't know if maybe that had something to do with that incident.
Well, that's pretty well documented. The nasal implant is very painful, and unfortunately it does happen to people, and I feel bad for them. I don't know what is the motive behind it or the necessity to do that to us, but it's definitely well documented.
Well, to look back on it, it seemed like some kind of a mass hypnosis or...
Yes. Yes,
something.
That's what I was trying to say before. They're very, very powerful mentally and otherwise. They are very good at projecting their thoughts to others, and that's how they communicate. Most of the time they don't even need to speak, although I'm sure they can because they clearly have done that, but that's not how they normally. Look, the thing is right now, just for me to speak to you, my brain has to actually think about it before the words come out of my mouth. So, in other words, the frequency, my brain is registering thought waves, right, that can be measured remotely. So in a way, they're just exchanging thought waves rather than going through the vocal cord. It's more direct that way.
So you still believe, though, Robert, that these visitors continue to come, both good and bad?
Absolutely. And it's obviously didn't start in 47. In fact, the first sighting that on the East Coast that's documented is 1639 in Boston. It was well documented. And it happened again in 1642.
Oh, I'm sure this has been going on since the beginning of mankind.
True.
I mean, if you know of Zechariah Sitchin's work.
I do know Zechariah. I've met him. He's a very interesting character. I've read all his books, and I'm sure he's right up to a point. I don't think that it's that simple. But if he's right about them being human and having a hand in our genetic makeup, then where do they go? Where are they? I really think they're still here.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Hey, George, Robert.
Hi.
Quick comment and a question, if I can.
Sure.
I heard John Lennon's Christmas song today, which reminded me of Lennon when he said he saw a UFO on his patio in Dakota.
In Manhattan, that's for sure.
And he had that song in Double Fantasy where he said, there's UFOs over New York, and I'm not so surprised.
True enough.
But the question I wanted to ask is, have you studied anything about the Phoenix Lights, UFOs over Phoenix, and also maybe the abduction of Travis Walton, which I thought was...
That's a great case.
Oh, boy.
Fire in the sky.
See, I hope you're sitting down for this because...
I am, and I'm standing, actually.
Okay, well, anyway, my friend JW told me that when he met Travis, he said, you know, that was the dumbest thing you could have done. You realized that you died. And that was an accident, by the way. When he ran up there, the field propulsion actually electrocuted him. And the reason they took him on board was to revive him. They literally brought him back.
Why'd they keep him so long?
Because he was dead, George.
They saved him.
They saved him. Yes, they did. And he knows it, too, by the way. According to what JW told me, he had a face-to-face with Travis, and Travis didn't deny it one bit. He was dead.
Interesting theory.
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
I knew one of the lumberjacks because I live in Phoenix.
Oh, yeah?
And many years ago, quiet kind of guy. And we were at a party one time, and we said, did it happen? He goes, he just shook his head, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they passed a lie detector test.
Yeah, he didn't want to really say anything about it. You know, he was kind of a quiet guy.
Yeah. I interviewed Travis once, though, and he did not say that he died.
Well, because he didn't even remember it. And it's a very embarrassing thing. He knows that it was a dumb thing for him to have done. And
did go running after it.
Yeah, he ran up to it, and he got electrocuted. And he's very fortunate to be alive, and I'm sure he's a different person because of the event. But why would anybody make up a story like that, you know?
Anything anything about the Phoenix lights that you know about?
I do know a lot about it, but I can't say who was involved.
I mean, they scrambled F-16s from Luke Air Force Base.
Well,
so-called UFO. People photographed it,
right?
And they said it was flares.
Well, okay. Now, when I spoke to the producers at Fox News in Phoenix, they said that they were totally skeptical up until the time they actually heard the audio between the air traffic controllers and the flight crews of the military aircraft, and those guys were freaking out. They had no idea what that was. They couldn't intercept something that size, and that convinced the folks at Fox News that there was something worth investigating, that it clearly wasn't flares, and the military was not in control of that situation at all.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Hello. Good morning, George.
Yes, sir.
Robert.
Hi.
Hi.
Robert, when I heard your story of what happened to your wife, I just had to go to the phone and try to get through, and fortunately I did.
Great.
It was so similar to what happened to me just 3 nights ago, and I'd like to get your reaction.
You're kidding.
For my method and the way it happened.
Okay.
Normally I would use a flashlight, and then it dawned on me to use my son's red laser pointer.
Uh-huh.
And I have my high-power binoculars, and I'll see objects flying up in the sky, very bright like stars, and if I hit it with the laser light and it changes direction, I know it's a UFO.
Huh.
And I, 3 nights ago, I was sitting there thinking and then saying out loud, when I got a hold of one that was moving not like a plane, mm-hmm. I said, come closer, be friendly. And this thing moved in, I swear, moved in right above me. It probably was a couple of miles still straight up above me. But then, all of a sudden, two more just came out of nowhere.
Wow.
And that's when I panicked and headed for my door because they got too close for comfort. And I don't know if anybody else has tried the laser light, but you mentioned that they might be afraid that they're targets for a laser light. And that's why I think they move when I do line it up and hit them with the laser light.
Wow. Where was that, sir?
This is on Cape Cod where I live.
Ah, East Coast. And yeah, well, as I was saying about Washington, D.C. is the UFO sightings capital of the world, but the 10 runner-ups for the next highest UFO sightings, they're all East Coast states surrounding Washington, D.C. There's something big going on out there in your area. It's huge.
I see them quite
not
often.
Just D.C. Yeah, you're not alone, but that's pretty interesting. And I've experienced that, too. When they do come close, you get really panicky because you don't know who they are or what they want, and that's just a normal reaction. But if you can keep your composure, I think that what comes next is profound. It's transformational.
I'll try to hang in there.
Good deal.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate you being part of the program. Are you concerned that government will try to shut you down?
Well, that's what I was saying before about my my book. I wanted to make sure it's look, I put that much effort into it. I don't want somebody to screw it up for me because they don't want it to come out. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can monkey wrench in publishing. You know, basically it goes to a printer, then it goes to a distributor, then it goes to the bookstore, and then it's, you know what I mean? If there's too many places they can monkey wrench it before it gets to the consumer. So I'm taking on the total responsibility of doing everything myself.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back. We'll take final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with our guest Robert Stanley. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Robert Stanley. We'll take the rest of the calls. Robert, they keep flying in here, and the clock is ticking, so let's go to them now. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. Is this George?
I hope it is.
Hey, it's first-time caller, all-the-time listener. I'm a security officer.
Well, thank you. Where are you calling from?
California.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, my name is Karen, and I just wanted to let you know that back in 86, I had a really bad accident where I was thrown over a balcony, and I was gone for like 10 minutes. And when I tell people this, they're like, wow, you know. But the big thing is that when I get to the point where I was in a room with nonverbal persons that read my mind and were telling me things of the future, it was really amazing because they, like, shifted me over to what looked to be like a computer and showed me things of the future and what might be what said to be like deja vu. to some people. I've seen on these computer, this like computer setting in fast motion, and things like that have been happening have happened on that fast motion setting. And I'm wondering if, you know, Robert can associate or has heard of anybody having this kind of an experience where, you know, like he said, this guy had died and I was gone for like 10 minutes and then I came back into my body again and then I went into a coma.
Well, that's a little different than what happened to Travis. His body was taken up on board the craft and he didn't come back for 3 days, I believe it was. Or anyway, I know what you're saying. You know, in the past, in fact, even in the present, a lot of people, they still refer to these beings as angelic or demonic, depending on their relationship with them and their intent. So
were really nice.
Yeah, well, but I'm saying people that are religious, have a very religious belief, they tend to look at these beings as being angelic, which I don't disagree with that one bit. I'm just saying that our perspective of these other beings around us has slowly evolved, and I'm not surprised that they were there for you, because I experienced that as a child too when I fell down some stairs. I mean, I was just an infant, and I went into a coma, and it took many years for me to remember that, but I do recall being with some of those beings, and I think they're always around us. We can't really see them.
Exactly, and I do feel like they're like when something major things are about ready to happen for like that split second. Like I had a propane tank in the back of my car one time, and for a split second I was done, and I'm back again, and I was totally white, and the guy sitting next to me that should have blew my car up was like, what the heck happened, you know? And yeah. I'm like, I don't know, but my heart was out of my throat. But I knew something was there and has been there with me all ever since this accident.
Right. They call them guardian angels. Some people are.
There's somebody.
Well, God bless you. I'm glad you're okay.
How many religious experiences have been occurring, but they're really extraterrestrial, Robert?
Right. I talked about that in the book with a couple people. Oddly enough, with Philip Kraft, that came up. But, you know, the thing that happened to Muhammad, where supposedly Archangel Gabriel took him from Mecca to Jerusalem and he met the prophets of the past and stuff, I'm sure that that was an extra-dimensional being. And, of course, when he tried to explain that to his peers, they thought he was crazy. They got really mad at him and said, you know, what's wrong with you? And some people threatened to kill him, but ultimately, look what happened. It became a religion to be reckoned with. So, yeah, I don't doubt it, that kind of, like I said, though, our perception is evolving. As we evolve, we're starting to see our relationship in through different eyes.
Okay, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Hi.
This is George from San Angelo,
hey,
Texas.
Hey, George. Welcome.
I have a question for Robert. You mentioned a while ago about the particular being that was brought as an infant.
Correct.
And the question I would have would be, do you think it's possible that some of the figures in our history, for instance, like Adolf Hitler or Mussolini, may have been brought the same way, or they could have been part of the same situation or other beings like that?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to say it's a little bit like a chessboard, that these, you know, some beings are more, some pieces are more powerful on the board. Some people are more powerful, and clearly they're placed here for a reason, you know. And if you think about it, this is my beef with the whole thing, with the war on terror. When does it end? Where does it stop? I mean, come on, you look back in history, and we've been at this forever. And have we ever come to an end? I mean, is there an end game here, or are we just being played for fools? It's because nobody really wins. When we go to war, everybody loses something. It's just ridiculous. And but I'm sure it's serving someone's agenda, and I can only assume that that is the dark side.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, George, appreciate you being part of the program. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Geza, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
Hi, Geza. Thanks.
Hi. I wanted to get your opinion on this idea. Earlier, you had mentioned where have those beings or aliens, where have they gone, the ones that were responsible for our for our creation, for our being, our, you know, the human creation.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get your opinion on this idea that there's this agenda that's been going on since way, way back, and you wonder what can be so important to go from so long ago up until our time now. And I was thinking, maybe these beings, they are privy to this knowledge of reincarnation and being aware of the entire process, and they're able to just appear throughout all the time periods up until this point in history, and they're able to carry out this agenda like velvet.
You know, Colonel Corso had said this too, that, and here's the problem. If you can warp space, you can warp time. So they may not, it may not be as though that they have to exist over the eons. They could literally jump from one point to another and another, and that they would, that way that they could serve their agenda that way, almost ensuring that whatever they wanted, the outcome. But the other problem is, or the other factor in here is, we tend to age very quickly because we just don't know all this. We haven't learned they're not giving us access to the information we need in order to live to be 1,000 years old. I'm sure that these beings do live to be at least 1,000 years old. Most of them do. And it's not a miracle thing. It's actually quite common.
Right, right. Okay, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Why did you say earlier that you also thought some of these bases were underwater?
Well, because the craft have been seen coming and going from the oceans and lakes. That's pretty well documented. In fact, you know, Bill Burns was on that History Channel. They did two specials about that. And it's really obvious. I've got plenty of examples of that in the book, specifically as it relates to the East Coast. And, well, here's the thing. If you can, obviously, if you're in outer space, you've got to be able to create an artificial environment or an atmosphere. So it's got to be just as easy for them to do it under the water. And, of course, underground. Now, here's the other thing. Living on the surface is really not a good idea. Yeah, it's beautiful up here, but it's foolish because we're being bombarded by cosmic rays. And eventually, sooner or later, we're going to get hit by something else from outer space. It just happens. And there's really no doubt about that.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so it's actually more conducive to longevity for us if we would live underground. And you know, there's a lot of ancient cities underground, George, around the world.
No, that's what I hear. We should be living underground, going to the surface for vacations.
Yeah, right, exactly. We'd live a lot longer. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Let's go to our international line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good.
This is JK from Niagara Falls.
Hey, JK.
How are you guys? I did actually, my grandfather's one of the masters of the lodge, as they say.
Oh, boy.
So it's kind of interesting to hear about that. I was just going to ask, you kind of see evidence of their intelligence through what you see as in, like, you know, do they go for the key points as far as, like, the keystones and stuff, like the keystone of the person's the mind, and the keystone of society is, like, the leaders, and so they tend to go for the mind of the leaders, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. But I was wondering, if you're talking about, like, the good guys versus the bad guys, and how, and I think it's a brilliant insight that, you know, we might be part of the bad guys, and that's why they don't want us to get access to the, honestly, but I was, what do you think there is for a good guy to do to kind of thwart maybe what is going on, or, you know?
That's an excellent question. What was your name again?
JK.
JK. You know, that I really like that your thought on that, because I've often wondered that myself, and that's why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. I'm sure that's why George does what he does. We're all trying to contribute to the evolution of our species, and it's not a trivial thing. You know, believe me, I'm sure there's things you've done even unaware, just a kind act, a kind word, you know, or sharing information with people. That's another way. I mean, I'm sure, you know, you've got the ability to do that if you so desire. So it's just making up your mind to actually work for the light. And you know, it's gradual. It's a gradual thing. You can't do it all at once, obviously. It's step by step.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Couple more minutes to go. A few more callers
Darn
will
it.
Take.
This, you know what, George? They say that time flies when you're having fun.
It does.
This went by in a blink.
I'm telling you.
You know what? I want to say thank you not only to you, but your audience has been really nice to me, and they're sending me these wonderful emails. I really appreciate it.
You are so welcome. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yeah, hi.
I have a comment for Robert.
Sure.
Or maybe a question. My dad told me some stories. He was in World War II. He was a minesweeper officer. Anyways, when he told me some stories when I was small, and then I went on to be in the military during the Vietnam era,
mm-hmm.
and was flying on some C-5s up in the cockpit, and you have to have a top security clearance for that.
Right.
And I took some pictures of some things that we saw, and freaked me out. It changed my whole just the way I looked at everything.
I imagine it does. Actually, everybody has that kind of experience at one point in their life. Most people won't acknowledge it. There's a lot of people, they live in denial of these things. And that's what I was trying to say before, is that we need to do something without looking to the authority figures to give us permission to have an open diplomatic relationship with these beings. You know, that's why I said we need to take this into our own hands and do something on a grassroots level and actually put global democracy into action. I'm sorry that I'm going on a rant about this, but, you know, these things have been seen by all kinds of pilots. And you know what happens to them if they come forward? They lose their jobs. And it's not fair, you know, because they're just up there flying around. That's what they do. And sometimes, especially the civilian pilots, like they've had to turn around. I interviewed this one Mexican pilot. Damn thing was playing games with him like cat and mouse, and so he had to turn his aircraft around and land it. And then after a couple hours, they got back up in the air, and it was there again. It was really upsetting him.
Have you ever had reports, Robert, of these UFOs gobbling up something like an aircraft or a boat, like
yeah.
we saw in the movie Close Encounters?
Well, yeah, Valentich, I think, was the guy off in New Zealand that happened to. His light aircraft was taken on board. That happened allegedly in Puerto Rico, according to Commander Dean. That aircraft and the pilot was abducted, taken on board one of the craft. I'm sure they can do that whenever they feel like it. And they do intervene, and believe me, they do watch us very carefully. I mean, sometimes, I swear to God, George, I feel like we're living on Uncle Milty's ant farm.
You may be right. First-time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hey, Kevin from Central California.
Hey, Kev.
Yeah, I just got a story for Robert, and I just wanted to see if he's ever heard a story like this ever before.
All right.
Speaking of cat and mouse again,
yeah.
I saw two stars up in the sky. They appeared to be stars, just looked like every other star.
Yeah.
And they're playing cat and mouse with each other, going all over the sky.
Yep.
Just going extremely fast.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they disappear, and a planet lights up. You can see the outline of a planet.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I was about 11 years old. It was about 94 when this happened.
Uh-huh.
And then they darted out from behind the planet again, and they just shot all the way across the sky until they were out of sight.
Were you sure it was a planet?
It could have been a moon. I don't know if the moon was out. I mean, it could have been the moon. Definitely it was the outline of a planet or a moon.
Well, I've got plenty of examples of this in my book where some of these craft are enormous. I mean, so enormous that when the militaries try to go up there, the guys are really glad that they can't reach that altitude, because what are you going to do with something that big? I mean, it's like a dog chasing a car. What are you going to do with it when you catch it? It's just ridiculous. But the bottom line is we are not in a position to negotiate with these guys, and they're obviously more advanced than we are technologically and otherwise. So I think it's in our benefit. I think it would be to our benefit to start acting openly welcoming them to visit with us. At least the good guys should be able to come down and give us some of the information we need.
And you think they're walking among us?
Well, I'm sure that there was a time in my life I would have questioned anybody that said that. But, yes, I'm absolutely convinced of that.
Remember the movie, yeah, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when it landed mm-hmm. and the door opened? First of all, you had a praying mantis-looking creature coming out, and then the little grays came out. Do you remember that?
Yep.
And I've heard a lot of reports of the praying mantis type.
You know who had a close encounter with one of those when he was a kid is David Adair.
Those are, yeah, you're right, and those are ugly creatures.
Yeah, that's enough to make anybody
I'd probably say that about us, but...
Well, of course. Well, see, but that's the thing I was trying to say about the movie Happy Feet. The bottom line is, and I won't spoil it, but it's about how do species, different species, communicate with each other, and is that beneficial or not?
Interesting. Well, Robert, we're out of time. Thank you so much. Give us your website one more time, sir.
It's unicusmagazine.com. That's spelled UNICUS magazine.com.
Great, Robert. I'll be talking with you about some other projects. I think you'd be interested.
Great. Well, you know what? I'll see you at that Consciousness
Conscious Expo? Life Expo, first of the year or so. It's in February, right?
February, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I'm going to be there.
I'll be there, too.
Great, George. Thank you so much.
Okay, that'll be in Los Angeles. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Wayne Roberts. I almost said Wayne Rogers again. Tom Danheiser, Gina Salvati, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.